What an iconic piece of music, the Bullet Theme by Claudio Lalo Schifrin, who passed away last week at the age of 93. What kind of self-respecting film music podcast would we be without acknowledging the passing of a true great, a maestro, whose work on cinema and TV included Cool Hand Luke, Enter the Dragon, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and of course, Mission Impossible. And with that iconic theme in mind, we've dug out a clip of Lorne Balfe, composer, and Christopher McQuarrie, who joined me to discuss Mission Impossible Fallout together from a previous episode. And there was just a really lovely conversation, obviously, around how Lorne approached that theme, you know, that existing theme, the weight of that existing theme, and also how you try and embrace it and make it yours. But then also a beautiful and very lovely story about seeking out the, not the recognition, but the kind of acceptance of Maestro about his use of the music. So we thought we'd play that for you now.
Well, it's that thing, I mean, you know, you have, my kids haven't seen the film, obviously, they're 5 and 10, they're a little bit young, but they
Are
know
they? Five?
They know that theme tune. Everyone knows that
yeah.
theme tune.
Oh, yeah.
Is it hard to pull back from it? Is it hard because we were watching, you were very kindly showed me this, a little piece from the, it's going to be on the DVD extras, where, Lauren, you kind of single out all the different cells.
Oh, yes. The foot chase.
Yes, yes,
it's
yes.
It's wonderful. And in that, the way that you almost kind of tease it at time, you know, mm-hmm. kind of it almost like pulsates in and then it disappears, and then it'll, you know, it's yeah. it's so clever the way that you have, you know, used it, I guess, to a point in it's subtly in Alien.
I think the thing is that, well, to me, I kept trying to always remember, treat it as if it had been written the day before,
mm-hmm.
because I think the whole, I think if you can easily go retro and make it sound nostalgic, which the film isn't. Mm. The end, I actually sent Lalo the theme arrangement.
Oh my God, really?
Because we got the same agent. So oh, I sent yeah. it to her. I got no reply. Like a month goes on and still no reply. And I'm thinking, God, maybe he just hates it. It must really be really bad. So then I kind of thought, well, when do I start asking this question? Firstly, does he check emails?
Yeah.
I don't know if he does or anything. Mm-hmm. I get told, yes, he does. He checks his emails regularly. I'm like, oh, God.
Great.
So then I'm doing a radio interview in Colombia, and there's a translator, and they're saying, what does Maestro think about your score? And I said, I don't know. I sent him it, but he never got back to me. So the interview finished. They called back 10 minutes later, saying, can you go on air now? I said, yes. They said, we've just spoken to Maestro.
No
oh
way.
Lalo, live in Los Angeles, and the translator's doing it. So then they're playing him, and he's listening to it live, like 3 or 4 tracks of the our end version that we did, and then our opening credit piece. And then he's listening to it, and then he's talking about
And he's hearing it for the first time.
Yeah, he was hearing it for the first time. So there's maybe a lot of politeness was said. But you know what? He said something. He said, it's such an honour to have this piece of music that has been throughout his journey still being remembered by people. And I think that it's because people write themes left, right, and centre, and it gets forgotten about. Yeah. But this is just now. This is part of folklore now.
That
you know, it's people. It's on people's phones.
Yes.
You know, it's commercials, and it's far more well known. Anyway, he was happy.
Okay, good.
So
good.
Maestro, I love that.
But now I can open that email he sent me. I've been afraid to even look at it.
Lauren Balfe and Christopher McQuarrie on Maestro Shiffrin, who unfortunately passed away last week. Hello then, and welcome along to Soundtrack, and thank you so much for your time and your attention today. We very much appreciate it. And our latest episode features another composer very much influenced by jazz, Antonio Sanchez. Now, Antonio joins us to discuss his work on The Studio, which, if you haven't yet, you have to do it because it's so, so good. It's such a fascinating, funny kind of look into the workings of Hollywood, basically, with Seth Rogen in the lead. You can stream the entire series on Apple TV Plus now. And we also managed to talk about his groundbreaking drum-driven score for Birdman. So trust me when I say that Antonio is fantastic company. So should we get into it? This is his cue, Temple of Cinema. Antonio, how are you?
I'm good, Edith. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well. Thank you so much for asking. Thank you so much for your time.
Of course. My pleasure.
Oh, your music's so great in the show. It's just so...
Thank you.
When you're watching the show on your own, it's almost like the music's kind of your companion. It's so great. So great. Talk to me a little bit about how the project was presented to you and kind of what those conversations were about, you know, what they were looking for, what your thoughts were, I guess, to start with.
Yeah, well, it came about in an interesting way because my agent told me, looks like Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg have been using the music from Birdman to temp their new series. So when they said that, then I figured, okay, well, if that's what they're doing, we can probably get a meeting at least to see what they're going for. And, you know, one thing that we all learned after Birdman is that drums and percussion are a very interesting way of scoring because it can create a lot of atmosphere, a lot of vibe, a lot of tension, a lot of stress. It's a great instrument for creating stress, as a matter of fact. We all found out about after Birdman. So we got a meeting, and then first thing both Seth and Evan told me, we're like, Matt, we just want to tell you Birdman is one of the all-time great movies. So obviously they were a fan of of the movie. And then they had checked out, obviously, what I did on the movie, but also on a couple other series I've done and some of my solo work. They knew the drum scoring would work, but they wanted to know if I was able to do other things, more orchestral stuff, because it was going to be needed. For example, on the Ron Howard episode, all the little bits and pieces of the Ron Howard movie.
Film. Yeah.
Yeah. Of the actual film, you know, I had to do that. So I told them, you know, I went to classical school. I studied classical music, classical piano. You know, I've been a composer for many, many, many years. So I basically sold myself highly.
Pimping yourself out. We've all got to do it.
Of course, in this industry. So at one point, Seth just said, oh, well, I'm sold. And then he just did his Seth laugh. And that was it. That was sealed the deal.
That was an amazing impression, by the way. That was so good.
It comes out so naturally for some reason.
Oh, wow. So many questions. It's almost like, as well, sometimes like the drums are kind of like, particularly Seth's character, who we're with so much in this show. It's almost this kind of internalization, almost in a way of kind of like, yeah, I've got to do this, got to do that. I've got to go here. I've got to go there. I've got to, you know, it's like, it's that kind of like pace that it's encouraging him to exist in a way. It's so brilliant. Right.
No, and a lot of people have said, which they also said the same thing about Birdman, that it kind of becomes a character in a way. And it was really nice because I finally got to meet the whole cast maybe, what, like 2 or 3 weeks ago in L.A. There was this huge event for the Emmys. And I just happened to be free and around L.A. around that time. So I went over there and I finally met everybody. And it was very nice because when I met Bryan Cranston and he found out I was the composer, he just said, man, it's really like another character of the series. And, you know, it's one thing if somebody tells you, and it's another thing if Bryan Cranston tells you. So that was really nice.
What was the kind of reality, though, of how you wrote for the show? I mean, it very much feels like you're playing, you know, in that similar vein to Birdman, that you're playing along live as you're watching it. It has that energy to it that we've walked into like this incredible room where live drums are happening. But what was the reality of kind of how you complemented the show and the characters in those scenes?
Well, it's been 11 years since I did Birdman.
Wow. When
I did Birdman, yeah, that's incredible. It was the 10th anniversary last year. We did a bunch of shows because I still do the live scoring events where they play the movie and then I do the whole thing live. The truth is that 11 years ago when I did that, I had no freaking idea of what I was doing. You know, I was just kind of going with the flow. And luckily, what Iñárritu wanted me to do was to improvise. Which that I can do very well because I've been a jazz musician for a long time. But, you know, it was, we did it in a day and a half, basically. It was incredibly quick. I don't know if it was because of time constraints or because that's what he wanted. Maybe he didn't want me to overthink too much what I was doing. But the truth is that I've learned so much just by doing those live shows. I just really was able to get inside the movie because I've seen it so many times and I've done it so many times. I knew every movement, every piece of dialogue. And I really started playing with that as I was doing it live. And then I started getting other scoring opportunities. I did the series Get Shorty a few years ago. I did one called The Anarchist. They wanted a more orchestral thing. I did another one last year called Stacks, was a UK-based show. Also, they wanted a lot more orchestration. But when the studio came about, I thought, well, now I really know how to do this. Now I really know how to get inside the scene. So what I do is I start from improvisation because composition is improvisation. It's just improvisation is on the spot. It's spontaneous. Composition, you can take your time. So I combine both. What I do is I'll get the episode and then I'll start marking the scenes like in my Pro Tools session. I see, okay, these are spots that are obviously very important, either movement-wise or dialogue-wise. And then I just try to find the right vibe to begin with. And then what I'll do is I'll start doing maybe 2, 3, 4 takes. And then by that moment, then I kind of see what works, what doesn't work. And then I start just refining it. So one thing that I've always used to my advantage as a jazz musician is space. So I really love, for example, if I'm playing, I'm scoring something, and then there's something important that is going to happen, instead of making it stand out with more music, I remove all the music. So I just leave space. And then one word really sticks out, which is, you know, the most important word in that dialogue. And then I just keep going. And so I'm always kind of intertwining with the dialogue and the movement. So I'll do a few takes. And then once I get the right vibe going, then I start editing the master take that I did. And once I have it really, really refined and I consider that, okay, it's hitting all the right spots, then I start doing other takes on top of it with different orchestration. Maybe I'll do one with just my hands, another one with brushes, another one with mallet. So they start getting bigger, but it's all based on this one master take that is very accurate. So then I actually do it with my screen and I can see the sound wave of my drums, of my original drums. And then I can just play off of that. When I see that I left some space in the master take, then maybe I'll do a brush flurry right there or with my hands or something. And then it just starts being like an internal conversation between all the layers of the drums, plus the conversation that is actually happening on screen. So that's kind of my MO.
It's amazing. So incredible. It's like to be a fly on the wall kind of whilst you're doing that as well, just be extraordinary.
And I've gotten really fast, which is really good too. Because I can do a couple of episodes per week now.
Whoa! You must need to know the episodes pretty well, you know, in terms of, because it's so fluid. There's so much movement. The camera's kind of just, sometimes it feels like one shot sometimes, you know, in terms of where we're kind of following these characters, you know, here, there and everywhere. And there are those kind of beats where it's like they're coming out of a trailer, or they're, you know, they're going into the office, or someone's arrived. So because of the nature of this relationship with the music and the rhythms that you've created with the visuals and the narrative. The precision is amazing, but it still feels freeform. So you must have had to really kind of study whether it was the scripts or the cuts or whatever that was.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I really watched the episode very closely first, the whole thing, just to kind of get the overall arc. And then I started going scene by scene. And like I said, I mark it very carefully. And then I try a bunch of different things as I'm doing. And some things immediately work, and then some things I'm not getting it yet. But that's absolutely my mission, to get as inside of it as if I was conversing with them at the same time. And also for me, dynamics are very, very important. So, you know, for example, I really enjoy doing the Martin Scorsese thin scene where he's talking about Jonestown and all that stuff. Just it's amazing how much just a little symbol hit before or after a word can do, and just kind of leave it hanging. Yeah, I mean, basically just coloring the dialogue that is happening and just helping it.
Do you have any other favorite episodes? Because I mean, that's the great thing I think about the show, is that it's got each episode it could be almost like a standalone little kind of feature in a way. But then as a whole, the great thing about it is you can't wait to dive back in to see what crazy situation that is very true to reality they've found themselves or they've managed to get themselves into. There are so many that I kind of really, really thoroughly enjoyed. I mean, the war I thought was brilliant. And then there's also that episode where they use the love theme from Chinatown as well. And he's playing up to being the kind of detective and all that kind of stuff. That's really clever.
That's my favorite one in terms of the challenge that it was to score that one. Because right off the bat, excuse me, they told me, you know, we want this one to be different because it's shot different. The storyline is different. Everything's kind of different on that one. So we want a film noir. Orchestration to it. And I was like, okay, that's great. So then they send me the episode. It had a lot of temp music from different composers, Jerry Goldsmith, for example. Mm-hmm. And the orchestration was just gorgeous. And I was like, oh, that's very, that's like, you know, because it's different to do it with when you have a full orchestra available to you and, you know, months to prepare. But this was like, okay, this has to be done quickly. And luckily, I've gotten very, very fast at also, you know, orchestrating in a very realistic way without the need of an orchestra, because that's another thing. Like a TV show like this, most of the time, the music budget is decent, but it's not enough to hire like an orchestra. And they told me, we want the film noir orchestration to start from the middle. We want the first half to be just like a regular scoring sound, which is basically drums and percussion. So that's what I did. And then, you know, once I found like the melody, the motif that really went with the whole thing, then I started just placing that in a bunch of different places. And I made it very dramatic and funny and interactive when we were watching. But then when I sent them the episode, they said, oh, well, we really liked what's the second half, but now the first half sounds kind of empty. So now I think we should do exactly. So then we should do the full episode like that. But I had already all the drums set up for the first half. So then when I started doing it, it's just like grabbing elements from the end and then just kind of placing them in different places in the beginning. Yeah, it was a great challenge because it had horns and it had woodwinds and brass, a lot of brass, and of course a lot of percussion. And the thing that I've discovered through the years is that if you have a very, very organic instrument as the base for the whole thing, which is obviously drums, then you can do a lot of MIDI layering on top of that. What you can do now with MIDI is amazing because they are actual samples of real instruments. So it's not like it sounds fake. But when you add the drums underneath that, then it just gives it a lot of authenticity right off the bat. So that was one of the most challenging episodes. And then the last episode also had a lot of different orchestration. Again, they told me this is going to be a different episode. So we went everything to be different. And that's one of the challenges, because there's almost standalone episodes. You have to crack the code of what the episode is, what the episode needs. And once you crack the code, then you can, it's easy. But cracking the code is the hardest thing. And they actually, on the last episode, they kept sending back notes like, it's not quite there yet. You know, we need this, we need that. You know, it's an art form to try to,
yeah,
to decipher what creative people want sonically, but their specialty is visuals, right? So then you have to try to, yeah, to decipher that.
It's so funny though, because considering the subject matter of the show and how it's having a really funny and very enjoyable kind of dig at the industry, and then kind of weirdly art imitating art in a way of you being part of this production and receiving notes and all that kind of thing.
Nice.
And there being like 20 producers involved and all that kind of thing.
Right,
it's like,
right.
Hold it's on, guys, very... where's reality and where's kind of, yeah.
It's all very meta, which is, yeah, one of the fun parts of the whole thing.
Yeah. It was so lovely what you were saying about that idea of having the opportunity to use sort of digitized versions of things. I had the most amazing, actually, was it on Monday? Last Friday, actually, as part of South by Southwest here in the UK, in London, Gustavo Santaolalla was here, and I did a session with him talking about his work, and he got his Rorroco out to play live to the audience, and was talking about how he was working with a company called Spitfire Audio and kind of recording.
Spitfire is amazing.
And almost kind of like solidifying his instrument, that instrument, into their system, so that everybody can kind of have the joy of this instrument, which is such a unique and little known instrument, really. But that lovely opportunity then that it's now got the opportunity for people to be able to use it in that way. It's so fantastic.
I think that's out already. I think I saw it advertised somewhere. And I'm like, I need to get that. When you're sampling real instruments, it just really creates a different vibe. And if you combine it with some other real instruments that you're actually playing, it's almost like AI. It's, yeah, very hard to tell the difference nowadays.
Yeah.
Very hard.
I've just spotted something I want to share with you. Can you just give me 1 second whilst I grab,
sure,
it? I want to show you this. Just realized I have it. Hold on. Look what I found.
Oh.
It's the Birdman, awesome, figurine.
Oh, man. I can't believe I don't have one of those.
I send it to you. With the authentic voice.
Authentic voice.
Yeah. How cool is that? I was like, oh, my God. I was like, just, it was staring me in the face with my little shelves up there as well. There's also something really lovely about celebrating drums as an instrument in composing, because it's, you know, it's always very much part of the orchestra, part of, you know, the percussion, part of the bigger picture. But for drums to be really sort of so front and center is really, really lovely, because it's the energy that you get from it as well. I think my 12-year-old plays the drums, and I love listening to him explore and feel. You know, it's kind of extraordinary. And also it's the few instances where he's holds back, where he's got to play with it. He played with a choir the other night. So he has to be so considered in his, you know, how he plays, the level he plays, so that he's not being too loud, so that we can hear all these different voices and things as well. I think it's an under-celebrated, would you call it an instrument? Are drums an instrument, or are drums, what would you, I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to undersell them by just saying it's by, because there are so many variations of it, of drums, yeah, different types of drums, different ways to play, different, you know.
And a drum set is not like a piano or a saxophone, that it's just what it is. You know, you cannot add things to the piano or to the saxophone. Maybe you can add effects or pedals or something, but you cannot add parts to it.
Yeah.
So a drum set is incredibly customizable. My drum set can be absolutely different from somebody else that plays, you know, a drum,
yeah,
set as well, just by removing, adding things. And it's so customizable, not only in the size of it, like the amount of parts you have, but also, you know, what type of cymbals you're going to use, how many cymbals, if they're jazz cymbals, they're rock cymbals. What you hit it with, obviously, it can be a brush, it can be a stick, it can be a mallet, it can be a rod. The type of drum heads you use, the tuning of the, because a piano should always be tuned as a piano. A drum set, you can tune it in a million different ways. And it's just such a personal, you can make it so personal, you know. So my instrument always sounds like me because I have my way of tuning it and I have my own setup. And I used three snare drums, who almost nobody uses. So it's just my own thing. But I think it's been severely underused.
Yeah.
You know, and that's because sometimes I feel Hollywood is so narrow-minded in the way that, okay, we know this works. And okay, orchestra. So orchestra for everything, you know. So that's why when somebody else comes along, like Trent Reznor, for example, and he did, you know, The Social Network, and all of a sudden it was a different way of scoring.
Yeah.
You know, and then people go like, oh, that also works. And then it becomes a thing. And, and now he's scoring like, you know, a million movies every year. And that was one of the really nice things when we met at the Golden Globes, when I did Birdman, he told me, you invented a new way of scoring that had never been done before.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a very specific thing that maybe it's not going to work for everything. But I think what they discovered is that, you know, it can create so much atmosphere without spelling out exactly what's going on, because it's very easy for, you know, soundtracks to really kind of spoon feed you what is happening. And then drums don't necessarily do that because they don't have, you know, major or minor tonality. They have other elements that, you know, an orchestra or a piano cannot replicate, but we're also limited by, you know, what the instrument can provide and what it can't.
Yeah.
But it can create so much without telling you, okay, this is supposed to be a sad scene and this is a happy scene. So, I mean, it can in a way, but it's not as obvious as some other scoring techniques can be.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you think of those moments where certain scores have really been a different approach. Like, weirdly, Trent and Atticus's score for Challengers, I thought was amazing. You know, it was almost like a rave record. It was like an EDM record. It was amazing. And it was like, this is like a kind of, you know, a dance electronic outfits album, but it worked so well with the story and the kind of the energy of those characters and the relationship as well. It's really, really true. What was it about composing for film and TV that really kind of inspires you? What do you love about it? What does it give you as an artist, as a creative?
Before I did Birdman, I had never thought about scoring anything.
That's crazy.
It never interested me. I, you know, because I had a very fulfilled career as a, you know, jazz musician. I was touring all over the place. I mean, I still tour all over the place with the best musicians on the planet. I do my own records, my own tours. So I was, you know, pretty busy with that. And then this opportunity came about. And of course, I was mostly thrilled to have an opportunity to showcase the drums as an alternative for a film score.
Yeah.
And to do it with Iñárritu, who I consider, you know, one of the most innovative filmmakers in history. It was, of course, you know, something I couldn't pass up, that opportunity. But the challenge for me is, of course, is very different when you compose for yourself and when you do your own records, you're your own producer and nobody's telling you what to do. And it's your own vision. And then all of a sudden, when you're trying to fulfill your vision, but you have to tailor it to what maybe 2, 3, 4 people tell you it needs to be. And also, of course, you have the visual element and you're trying to fit music within 2 minutes and 32 seconds, you know, and which is a challenge because you want it to flow like it was always meant to be that way.
Yeah.
And it needs to really end at the right time and, you know, the right way. And all those little adjustments that you have to make that you don't really have to worry about when it's just audio and it's your own record. That's always a learning experience. It's always difficult. And it's I think it just makes you a better musician all around.
Yeah.
You can customize your art in that way, but still come across as, okay, this is who I am. I'm just doing it into a different medium.
How did that opportunity come about with Birdman? How did it present itself to you? How if you don't mind me asking.
That, of course, that was because it's a really interesting story, because when I was growing up in Mexico City, I used to listen to a great radio station called 96.9 WFM. And Iñárritu
was a DJ on it. Yeah.
DJ. Yeah. So I was heavily influenced by the music that was being played on that station. And then one night, because they had a nightly show called Magic Nights, where they would play a little bit more sophisticated music. And one day I'm listening and this song comes on, this tune, and I'm like, wow, this is so cool. And back then I was really into rock. I was like a rock head.
Yeah.
And I was playing rock, and I had my rock bands. But this tune just really caught my ear. I was like, wow, this is so cool. It was it had wordless vocals and a really haunting melody and a very haunting beat and beautiful harmony. And it was nothing like I'd ever heard before. And then a voice came on. I can't remember if it was his voice or not, but it said this was the last streamed home by the Pat Metheny group. So I was like, oh, Pat Metheny was cool. Then, you know, fast forward many years, I moved to the States in 93, then 99, I moved to New York. And in 2001, I got the gig with the Pat Metheny group, and we were playing that same song. We were playing all, you know, all these things that I had been checking out now for years because of Iñárritu. So I discovered the Pat Metheny group because of Iñárritu. Then I ended up playing with the Pat Metheny group. And then he comes to our show in LA in 2005, because obviously he was a fan. And then we met after the show. I didn't recognize him. I just, you know, I knew his name, but I didn't really know his face. And there was an after party. And, you know, I was just trying to get to my dressing room, and he taps me on my shoulder, and I turn around, and, you know, this guy like, oh man, I just want to tell you, it's so cool that you know, you're from Mexico, right? And you're playing with one of my favorite bands. And I'm like, oh yeah, thanks, man. You know, but I didn't really know who he was. But he seemed very knowledgeable about the band, about music in general. And we had a great conversation. And he told me, man, this, you know, you did this solo tonight. It was like, if you're an octopus, you know, he could mention like a pulpo, you know, that's the word for octopus in Spanish. You're like pulpo. I'm like, oh, well, thanks. And then at one point I said, and man, what do you do? You know, you're from Mexico, obviously, but what do you do here? I'm like, oh, you know, I direct films and commercials. I'm like, everybody in LA directs films and commercials. You know? So I wasn't really impressed by that. And but then I asked him anything I would have seen. And then he said, well, you know, I did this thing called Amores Perros and 21 Grams. And then I was like, oh my God, I was so embarrassed. I said, I'm so sorry. Aww. I didn't recognize you. I gave him a hug. He was super cool. And then we just remained in touch. Every time he would come to New York, he would let me know when he was going to be an opening for one of his films, and I would go usually with Pat Metheny. We would go together. And then one day out of the blue, he called me and he said, man, I have this new project, and I'm thinking it's a dark comedy, and comedy and rhythm go hand in hand. And I will never forget that solo, man. You were like that octopus, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, do you want to give it a shot? I'm like, of course. And I after I said yes, I was, you know, in Miami, and it was just a quick call over the phone. And then I hung up, and, you know, from elation, it turned into terror. It like in like 1 minute, I was like, oh my God, I'm going with a drum set. I'm going to a score like an Iñárritu film. What the hell, you know, and it really freaked me out. But I kept thinking, he knows what he's doing. So just trust the process. And then, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah. Oh yeah. What a great collaboration. Just a brilliant and beautiful collaboration. I'm so excited to see what's next. I hope we get the chance here in the UK for a live Birdman playback. That would be amazing. I don't know if you've done one. Have you done one here in the UK?
Yeah, I did the Barbican
once.
Oh,
great.
Was it the only one I've done at the UK? I think that's the only one. Where are you based, in London?
I'm just outside London in, do you know Bristol at all? It's
yeah,
kind of,
yeah, sure.
so I'm kind of between London and Bristol. But yeah, oh man, I would love to. I would love.
Yeah.
I'm gutted. I missed it at the Barbican, but I would love to see that.
Well, I'm coming twice to London in July with two different bands.
Are you?
At the London Jazz Festival and then
Yeah.
Ronnie Scott's later
Oh,
on the month.
great. Okay, I'm going to come and watch for sure. I'm going to get online and find out where that is and when that is and come and watch.
Yeah, come
But
by.
yeah,
I'd
I'd
love to
love
meet you in
be
person.
great to see you in person as well. It'd be great and watch you play live. Oh, it'd be so great. Thank you so much for your time today,
Of
Antonio. It's so
course.
great to chat to you and celebrate your
My
amazing
pleasure.
work.
Thank you so much.
On just a few of the titles, we've not really kind of managed. We never could cover everything in the time that we had, but it's lovely to celebrate Birdman as well as the show as well. So it's
Thank
great
you.
to get the chance to chat to you about that, and also just celebrate the drums, I think, for sure.
That's the best part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From his incredible score to Birdman, that's Strut Part 1, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Antonio Sanchez. My huge thanks to Antonio for being such a magnificent guest, such great company, and giving us a wonderful, revealing insight into his process. Head to edithbowman.com if you'd like to hear my interviews with Alejandro González Iñárritu back in episode 341, or any of our other episodes of the podcast for that matter. Follow us on your socials. We're at Soundtracking UK, and we also have a YouTube channel called Soundtracking Extra, which we'd be most grateful if you'd subscribe to. Next up then, talking about more iconic themes. If I sang this to you badly, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Gareth Edwards, who, if you've listen to this podcast in the past, you'll know I'm a massive fan of Gareth, from way back his film Monsters through to his take on Star Wars with Rogue One, and kind of everything else that he's done. And it's really interesting in terms of the choices that he's made, in that he's clearly a fan of cinema, and it's really lovely that he's almost kind of fulfilling childhood dreams with some of the choices, not all of them, but some of the choices that he's made, and now doing a Jurassic Park film. But we're also going to be chatting to Alexandre Desplat. So next up, Gareth Edwards and Alexandre Desplat talking Jurassic World Rebirth. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.